Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you via the internets from San Francisco. Our new website's refurbished, redesigned, and ready for you to access at peterbcollins.com. And there's a subscription button if you'd like to help. A lot of people have said they want to make a monthly contribution to help defray our costs of production and distribution. And that's available to you now on our updated website at peterbcollins.com. I thank you, each and every one of you, for your support of this new adventure. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to get a report from the National, I always want to say National, it's NRDC, stands for Natural Resources Defense Council, and they've published a new study, and for a change, California is number one. It has to do with the environment and emissions and policies and things like that. But first, we're going to be asking some questions here, and all the questions are going to start with why. Why? Timmy Thomas is warming up for us here with a song called Why Can't We Live Together? And joining us today is Andrea Batista Schlesinger. Her new book is called The Death of Why, The Decline of Questioning and the Future of Democracy. And this is not our first encounter with Andrea. She has been the executive director of the Drum Major Institute in New York for many years now, and working to advance the interests and the issues important to the middle class. And she does a great job at that. She also serves on the board of The Nation magazine, one of my favorite progressive publications. And I learned for the first time from her book that as a high school student, she was the student member of the Board of Education in New York. Andrea, that's a fascinating little insight to your early involvement in policy and politics. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine.
Yeah, good. What was it like to be on the school board as a student?
So many years ago. Well, I definitely credit that experience for launching me into a public policy career and for shaping the way, for example, I think about how policy is made. It was my job then to represent the students of the system, 1.1 million of them, and it was very clear to me that even though they were the primary consumers of education, that there was absolutely no interest in engaging students in the actual decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, really taught me that, you know, you can only change the conversation by changing who participates in it.
Yeah. And what kind of respect or lack of it did you get from the adult members of the school board?
Well, I think it was person-by-person basis. I think all of them found it amusing, but I, and certainly I had supportive relationships with some members. I think, you know, it was an adjustment period for everyone. I was one of the first students on the board, but, you know, I tried to use the only tools that I had at my disposal to ask questions of those people in power who came before the board and to try to get students into positions where they could ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly also to figure out how to use the press who were interested in the provocative statement coming from a 16-year-old, and I was more than happy to oblige.
And did you cut some of those backroom deals, wheeling and dealing with other members of the board?
I don't think I knew where the back rooms were. So, no.
Well, Andrea, one thing before we dive into your book, which is fascinating and raises a lot of important questions, I have a why question for you. And in fact, Del Shannon is going to warm up for us here. Del? Now, why did you run away, take a leave of absence from the Drum Major Institute to join the campaign of the Mayor for Life of New York City, Mike Bloomberg?
He's not the mayor for life. Well, the answer is very simple. You know, my life is about trying to move progressive policy. Mm-hmm. And I was asked if I wanted an opportunity to do that, to think about how to move progressive policy for the next 4 years of my home city. And it was, as they say, an offer that I, what's the saying? It was an offer I couldn't refuse.
You couldn't refuse.
You know, the Drum Major Institute is national, but, you know, we're one of those think tanks that thinks it's important that you care about where you actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been involved in thinking about New York policy for a long time and always saying in the back of my head, if only, if only. And so this was an opportunity to work for someone who was interested in my views and in my thoughts,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't pass it up. Like I said before, you change the conversation, you change policy by changing who's around the table.
Sounds like you're an inside agitator.
You know, it doesn't feel like agitation because there is a lot of welcomeness to my views, and I also think, you know, this isn't an unprogressive mayor. In many ways, he's a progressive mayor on environment, on taking, being the only one who's willing to take on the gun industry, you know, being the only person as a Republican willing to say years ago that we needed a pathway to legalization, that
mm-hmm.
we needed, you know, on the Wall Street Journal op-ed pages, no less.
Poverty.
I mean, you know, I think this is a, let me put it this way. You know, the way I've always defined progressive is, do you believe government can and must play a positive role in people's lives?
Mm-hmm.
And I think based on that score, this is a progressive mayor. So I feel good about what I'm doing.
Well, and tags aside, I do consider Bloomberg, to be part of that endangered species, the moderate Republican. And we mm-hmm. had Nelson Rockefeller from New York, Chuck Percy from Illinois, and these are fossils. These are people who haven't been around for a long time because partisanship really did harden. Starting with Reagan in the 1980s, and we also saw the conservative wing of the Republican Party take control and squeeze out a lot of those moderate voices on the GOP side that we used to rely on for that quaint notion of bipartisanship.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting experience to work for someone who doesn't identify himself ideologically. And I surely do. I identify as a progressive, as you well know,
mm-hmm.
and I have been accused of being an ideologue in the past. But it actually makes you work harder because when I'm making a case for policy, I have to work harder
mm-hmm.
to make the case for why something is beneficial, to make the case for why it's beneficial to the entire city. And, you know, frankly, it's making me a smarter advocate, and I think I'll be a smarter advocate when I leave the campaign and return to the Drum Major Institute, which I'll do in November.
Now, did you turn down an offer from the campaign of Reverend Billy?
No, I didn't.
Did you talk to them before you jumped onto the Bloomberg bus?
I didn't.
Oh, I could have arranged that.
I didn't. I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh. Well,
but I am enjoying his campaign.
Yeah. I think Reverend Billy is right there at the intersection of performance art and political theater, and I love him for that. And I hope
think he has a very smart platform, but so does the Naked Cowboy. I don't know if you know about the Naked Cowboy who's running for mayor.
I've seen him on Times Square, yeah.
Well, his platform is, of course, transparency. So, it's an interesting time, but I feel good about what I'm doing.
All right, two more questions here. Will Bloomberg debate any of his opponents before November?
Yes.
And will Billy be invited?
He needs to have we're still not at primary season. The primary season is still on.
Okay.
So you have Democrats running against Democrats, and, you know, so you have to get past the primary season before you do.
The primary is in September then?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then my final question about this is, you resisted my terminology of mayor for life, but with the lifting of term limits, can't Bloomberg run as many times as he wants?
No, this was a one-time lift.
Okay.
That the city council approved, voted on pretty overwhelmingly. And to do a permanent lifting of term limits, you'd need to take a different kind of action. This was a one-time one type of thing.
Well, I can handle it this time. When Giuliani was angling for that, it really gave me pause.
I am completely with you on that, especially since I was working at the time for a Democrat who was running for mayor. So I agree.
Now, tell me why you decided to write this treatise about curiosity, about skepticism, based on the whole question, why?
Well, you know, and I'm sure you well know this, that, you know, so much of what happens is cyclical as students of history. And as an activist, I guess what was in my mind was, you know, so many of these victories and so many of these questions are, you know, so many of these debates are fleeting. And, you know, we can't fix everything forever. You know, we can't fix climate change forever. We can't fix education forever. We can't fix Social Security forever, because these are representative of larger questions that society is going to continue to have over and over again. And so the question for me was, of course, I'm going to fight for progressive policy now. But what can I truly do to see that we have a progressive country? And my concern in looking at the direction of our schools, in looking at our broader culture, and looking at the way in which the internet has changed culture, my concern is that young people aren't being raised today in an environment that values questions. And so as a progressive, my concern is if we don't raise a generation and generations after that generation of people who are prepared to ask questions, how are we ever going to truly see a progressive agenda endure?
Mm-hmm. And Andrea, you touch on an important point to me at a couple of spots in the book, and that is how we have ended up with ghettoized information delivery. And it is really stark in my business, where I'm a liberal radio talk show host, and we are outnumbered 9-1 by the conservatives on AM radio. Mm-hmm. And 15 years ago, I used to follow Rush Limbaugh on one of the top radio stations in San Francisco. And it was a common practice to have a conservative and then a liberal, maybe a centrist, a moderate who did the neener-neener thing. But now we have red and blue media. And I, for one, bristle at being ghettoized because, hey, it's fine to be on a progressive station and talk to like-minded people. But I'm much more interested in mixing it up with the people who don't agree with me or who don't have an opinion. And trying to persuade them, and I'm not allowed to, because the way media has evolved after deregulation, we basically are, you know, put in these pigeonholes, and you can't get out. And the impact on the public and their knowledge is in stark display this August, as these yahoos go out with corporate-prepared talking points to bust up public meetings, town hall meetings about healthcare.
Well, you know, what I do in the book is I start, as you know, trying to think about how do young people and how do children really develop curiosity and learn to inquire. And what the psychiatrists and others, the people who study infants, told me, and it's simple, but I think it's profound, is they begin to inquire when they encounter the unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what I write about in the book is this ideological segregation that is happening, taking place both in where we live. So I reference the big Bill Bishop's work and the Big Sort and how people are literally moving to be closer together to and live with those, you know, with whom they share a worldview.
Mm-hmm.
We are segregated online. You know, I mean, you can spend all day online and hardly encounter an opinion that you disagree with.
Yeah, I just stay away
with in terms of degree.
I just stay away from World Nut Daily and I'm fine.
Right.
And News Mux?
And certainly in the media that we listen to, and we increasingly listen to a polarized media. I mean, there are some tests, studies that I quote in the book where people were, you know, so intent upon consuming media that fit their ideological background that even when it came to clicking on a sports story, they were more likely to click on a sports story from an outlet whose ideological opinion they trust. And so, you know, I think that we're becoming, I call it in the book, by click or by click, you know, with the two different spellings, ideologically segregated. In my view, there's nothing wrong with having a strong view of the world, of course. But I worry that for people who are being raised in this current environment, who don't have a different, point to reference for a different time. I was taken aback or struck by the Cronkite reminiscences of how his, you know, that's not possible anymore. But people who are raised in an environment where they can't even think of the alternative, you know, how is that going to affect their desire to inquire, to think, to question, you know, how they look at the world? And I think that's something we need to be asking.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's take a minute here to talk about a professor from Stanford who you cite in the book, and I'm not mispronouncing her name. It's Carol Dweck. There's no R in there. And she studied some grade school students, and the way we reinforce learning and the capacity for knowledge has an impact on how people channel their own inquisitiveness. Tell us a little about that.
Well, you know, her work is very interesting. She looks at the notion of self-esteem and this idea that trying to pump up the self-esteem in young people is actually preventing them from inquiring and from challenging themselves. I mean, she did this experiment with two groups of, I think it was fifth graders, I'm forgetting now.
Fifth or sixth, you're right.
Naturally.
Yeah.
It was a little while since I finished the book. And, you know, they took an exam, and it was in a few parts. They took the first part, and one group of students were told, wow, you must be so smart. You did really well. You must be so smart. And the other group said, you know, were told, you did really well. You must have tried really hard. And, of course, on the second round, they were given a choice. Do you want to take the same level of exam, or do you want to move to a harder exam? And the group that was praised for being so smart stuck to the same level. And the group that was praised for their effort wanted more of a challenge. And, you know, the moral of the story here, of course, is that the students who were praised for their intelligence, you know, wanted to preserve their reputations as smart, and weren't as interested in inquiring. And, you know, what I take from that is the increasing value, I think, on the end result and not on the process. And I see that manifested throughout our educational system, where it's about getting the right answer, and we don't emphasize, value, reward the process of getting to that answer. And unfortunately, all we have, or fortunately, however you look at it, all we have is the process. Knowledge changes. The right answer changes. And without getting on my high horse about that, I obviously feel passionately about it. But, you know, I think it's in our nation's DNA these days to emphasize our strengths and not to emphasize our national process of questioning ourselves and putting in that effort to do so. And I do think that that makes us shy away from challenges.
Well, Andrea, and just to make this a little personal, you and I have talked maybe 8 or 10 times over the last few years, and I find you to be a person, like me, with no shortage of self-esteem, self-confidence. But it's something that wasn't given to us.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, but as I see the generation that we're raising, I'm in my 50s, I have a stepson who's in his early 20s, and we operated in a way that often did not permit our kids to fail. And so they didn't learn from mistakes. They've only learned from positive reinforcement. And, you know, positive reinforcement isn't a bad thing. But if it's all you're working from, if that's all your self-esteem is based on, and then mom suddenly exits the picture and isn't there pumping you up all the time,
right?
Then you lose that reservoir because it's not internalized. It's something that is accessed externally, like a portable hard drive or a flash drive or something.
Right, right. I think it's a tough thing. I think you obviously want to in this very competitive environment, you want people to believe in, and young people especially, and children to believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's so funny that you're asking me this question, that we're talking about this, because, you know, I'm like a progressive policy person who works for a think tank. I mean, you know, currently childless. I mean, it's interesting that I moved in this direction, and I have people, fellow progressives and so forth, who have said, you know, who've read the book and said, wow, it's really changing the way I think, or enhancing, or giving me a lot to think about as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny how you wind up in these in that place. But, you know, I think the same thing is probably true, and this is the parallel that I make, between, you know, having national pride, for example, but also trying to create the space in which one is willing to take on challenges. And that means having to accept that the answer isn't always going to be right and that the performance isn't always going to be perfect. And I think that's that there isn't always certainty. And that's a tough message to communicate, both to a country as it is to a child. And I don't want to belabor the parallel, but I think at least up in, you know, to this point, it holds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the trick, is how do you create the space in which there's safety, but also create the space in which you're safe to question. And, you know, I just think as people who care about the direction of the world, that as much as we think about the current debates and healthcare and so forth, that we also need to be having this discussion, too.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Batista Schlesinger with us, and her new book is called The Death of Why, subtitled The Decline of Questioning and the Future of Democracy. Andrea, you tell an interesting little story here about an encounter you had on the Lou Dobbs show on CNN. Where he was talking one stream, and you had been invited there expecting to talk about something rather different. Explain that to our listeners and how you felt afterward.
Well, you know, I had written a letter to Lou. The Drum Major Institute had done a fair amount of work in answering or exploring the question of what's the stake of middle-class Americans in immigration reform. And, you know, and I, our conclusion was that there are many ways in which the middle class benefits from the contributions of immigrants, documented, undocumented, across the way. And so our, you know, the take to Lou was basically, we don't think you're being fully fair in talking about the way in which immigration and the presence of immigrants, documented and undocumented, affects the pocketbooks, frankly, of middle class Americans. And I sent him this letter, and he called me himself. Like, I picked up the phone, and he said, "Hi, it's Lou." And I said, "What?" You know. And
yeah.
He said, "Come on the show. Your letter's smart. I want to talk to you about it." And as I talk about in the book, from the second that I sat down, of course, we weren't having a conversation about what I had written in the letter. Instead, he was essentially asking me to disprove his contention. And so there were very few actual questions. There were statements that had a question mark at the end of it, but all designed to reinforce his point and to put me completely on the defensive. Now, I think that's okay in a debate, but this is supposedly a news show, and I was supposedly invited to talk about the smart letter that I had sent. Now, am I naive? Perhaps. But I think it speaks to the way in which we have conversations, and I contrast in the book that experience with America's Town Hall on the Air, a program, you know, a long time ago.
Now, that's a long time ago, Andrea, and you're younger than I am, and I don't remember. Who's this guy, Denny? His name was Denny?
Yeah, I don't actually, I wasn't alive then, I admit, but I came upon this show. And,
it was here in your book, it says it was on starting in 1938. So we're both in the clear on that.
We're in the clear, but you can actually listen to it. You can find some of the shows.
Here he is, George V. Denny Jr.
If you Google it and you Google, I think there's one website where you can go and actually listen. There's a great show on mm-hmm. Social Security with Francis Perkins. And, I mean, it's terrific. But the whole idea of the show was for people of opposing views to air them out and for the audience to ask questions. And, in fact, he would give the audience member with the best question a prize. And it was there were discussion groups, people in their home that would, you know, actually pride themselves on the extent to which they changed their minds. I mean, can you imagine? And he had a lot of followers. He had a lot of listeners. He didn't do so well when he transitioned into TV, but he had a lot of listeners. And so it's just, I shouldn't have been surprised by the awful experience that I had, which, of course, was followed up by the minute I was off the show, my inbox was already flooded with critiques on everything from, you know, what I had said to I'm just a, you know, an immigrant, blah, 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 mm-hmm. that wants to be let off the hook to, frankly, to what I was wearing. I mean, it was somewhat obscene and disturbing of a process, but
did anybody
ask me any questions.
Did anybody ask for your birth certificate?
No, but I think if I went on today, they probably would.
And what are your current thoughts about Lou Dobbs? Some people are saying that CNN should fire him for continuing to pursue the birther issue. And this is about why, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's overboard, and I think it's ridiculous. But, you know, I think people are entitled to raise the question, and their free speech rights apply to idiocy as well as thoughtful pursuits.
I think the strategy should be that people of sound mind should not go on the show anymore. And I think the problem is that when people continue to go on the show, he has cover and he's viewed as a leaning right but mainstream voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think essentially we need for the ghetto in which he operates to become clearer. And so, you know, I pledged I would never go on the show again, not because it's hard or not, you know, I mean, I debate folks all the time.
Yeah.
But I think people who are, well, sane and who are interested in a productive conversation should no longer go on the show. And I think once the network understands fully that this is a fringe discussion, then they will be faced with the conversation of what kind of network they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's somewhat silly to ask them to fire him because he's pursuing a story that they don't, that we reject. I don't think that's enough. I think we have a two-step process here.
I also think that simply turning it off is an expression that a viewer can make, because if the ratings go down, ultimately CNN will replace Lou Dobbs with a Larry King rerun or something like that.
You know, there are new voices, though, that are making their way on. And, yeah, I mean, I don't think that even if Lou is off the network that we've fundamentally changed anything about the direction of our media. And I also think people are all watching for a reason. So, again, this only further supports, for me, the question of, you know, how, in which environment or in what kind of environment are young people being raised in today?
Mm-hmm.
So beyond our own personal frustrations, you know, what is it like and how are they going to learn? And what's that, you know, how are they going to form opinions? Or will they just tune out? And one of the things that, as you know, I talk about in the book is the relationship of young people to the news. And, you know, despite the fact, and I push back a little bit on this narrative about young people being the most politically engaged generation, according to Pew, you know, young people ages, I think it's 18 to 24, I believe, but it could be a little bit wider. It could be 18 to 26 or 18 to 28. I need to check. You know, one in three have no meaningful interaction with the news on any given day. I'm including online, by the way.
Yeah.
So it's not, and of course, and I detail this in the book because I have a particular thing, and perhaps this is anachronistic, but about the actual print newspaper, like that actual thing that you touch and hold and turn the page and you don't know what you're going to see, as opposed to, you know, some serendipity, as opposed to the process of scanning headlines. But all of the research shows that the way young people engage with the news is very shallow.
Yeah.
They graze, they click, they get alerts. I mean, it's very selective, again, not encountering the unfamiliar. And, you know, I worry that if this is the direction of news consumption, that, you know, we're going to have a problem.
Well, and my son David learned a lot of American history from the joke scenes on The Simpsons.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, they would have a Nixon character, and during the commercials, I would explain to him who Nixon was and why that was funny. But a lot of this is accessed not through the process that you and I went through in the olden days at the old school, you know, where we read a book about it, maybe saw a boring documentary, took a trip to Washington, and had some people with bad breath explain things ad nauseum. But, you know, a lot of this is not only received knowledge, but it is received in a far different frame. The other example of that is the people who get their news from Jon Stewart. Bless Jon Stewart.
Right, I agree.
But he, in order to set up a joke, he gives you enough information that's based on reality and something that really happened, maybe even a video clip of that politician. But it never gives you the full context. And I have no indication that Daily Show viewers the next morning start madly clicking away to find out the context of a joke that Jon Stewart gave the night before.
Right. And I agree on the God bless him front. And I don't have a problem with people getting information from Jon Stewart. And I also don't expect people to sit around and read newspapers all day. You know, I have the benefit of having a job in which I need to. But, you know, I write in the book, I spend a lot of time on schools in the book, and I write about civics education. And again, you know, it's usually like a laugh off the stage type of thing at like a progressive conference. But I think, you know, we need to be thinking about how young people are learning both their responsibilities and rights as citizens and developing habits. And, you know, I think, silly as it is, reading the newspaper every morning is a habit of an engaged citizen. And, you know, I write in the book about, in my chapter, No Piggy Bank Left Behind, about the financial literacy movement, this movement to teach financial literacy in the schools. And to me, that's the perfect example. You have, on one hand, the decline in civics, where you're given the space to question your democracy, and you have the rise in financial literacy education, where you're essentially given the answer. Here's the market. Learn how to work it. Don't question it. Learn how to work it. And I'm oversimplifying, of course. It's not like a teacher sits there and says, oh, I'm going to do financial literacy instead of civics. But I think it speaks to a changed understanding of the role of the public schools in preparing citizens. And I don't think it's enough of a conversation today. I think, you know, glad, of course, that we have a new president, of course. I'm understanding it here. And then, therefore, a new direction in education policy. Glad that he's thinking about things that his predecessor didn't. Early childhood education, for example. Mm-hmm. Community colleges, for example. These are things that I'm also working on here at the campaign. But I don't think that they're engaged in a fundamental process here of questioning what is the role of the public schools, which to me means you start with what kind of citizens do we want to make, and therefore, what do we want the schools to produce?
Mm-hmm.
And if we want the schools to produce something, then okay, then how does our curriculum reflect that? And, you know, so that's another area, a big area in which I think, you know, we need to be engaged in the conversation. And school is hard to talk about education. And there's generally, you know, people who want this, people whose issue is that. And we don't have a cross-cutting conversation about what their role is in our democracy. And, you know, again, not to be too lofty about this, but I think it's something we need to be thinking more about.
You can be as lofty as you want.
Thank you.
Andrea, in one chapter of the book you call In Google We Trust, you note that, and here again I think we're focusing on younger generations, but they have massive amounts of data available at their fingertips. They don't have to go to the library and know the Dewey Decimal System. You just click and information appears. What's wrong with that? What's lacking?
Well, my concern is that the prevalence of search engines in our lives is redefining the way we think about questions. And you know, I write in the book about this commercial that struck me as reflective of this, but it's for a cell phone that has a partnership with Google. And, you know, the questions are, you know, do sharks have eyelids? Do twins have the same fingerprints? And, you know, I mean, these are interesting questions, but that's not curiosity. Like, that's not inquiry. You know, inquiry, you have to synthesize things. You can't just, which is the search pattern, and I review many studies in the book of the way children interact with the net, where you plug in something and you get responses and you pick the first three that a search engine gives you and you print them out and you rinse and you repeat and then you're done. That's not inquiry. You have to synthesize. You have to think critically about what you see. You don't just search once, then you have to narrow your search. And, you know, I mean, it's a process of then analyzing and thinking about what's the credibility of this source. I mean, this skill of discernment, I think, you see all around us now as this healthcare debate unfolds, is one that is lacking. A value around discernment is lacking. Now we pride ourselves on the extent to which misinformation can become true, as opposed to priding ourselves on the extent to which we really question the source of information.
Yeah, but Dick Armey's doing all that thinking for me. And he boils it down to talking points and tells us to go out and disrupt a town hall meeting.
That's true.
I mean, come on, it's so easy.
That's true. I think I'm looking for us to put in a little more effort, and that's silly, because I think we're all working harder, we're more productive, we're getting paid less, and we should just take a break.
That's not a bad idea. Andrea, you also focus on an interesting place here in San Francisco that I'm pretty fond of. It's called the Exploratorium. Tell me what your interest is there and how it relates to learning and curiosity.
Well, I went to visit the Exploratorium, and there's an Institute for Inquiry. Of course, I had to go because it's called the Institute for Inquiry, and I was writing a book on inquiry. And the whole purpose there is to enable teachers to think about inquiry-based learning, to create a space in which they're thinking about inquiry-based learning, which is really just allowing the questions of the students to determine the path of the lesson, as opposed to, you know, starting with an answer. And, you know, one of the things that an Institute for Inquiry staff person, one of the researchers, and there told me, just in the course of a regular conversation, but again, it stuck with me, is this idea, you know, when you learn the scientific method, at least for me and for people that I talk to, the first step was develop a hypothesis. And that's not the way scientists work. That's essentially you come up with an answer and then you work your way back. Instead, you start with a question. And it's just you interact. And it's just an interesting way in which, you know, science is really, and I'm not a science person, but it is one of these places in which you really, in which inquiry is valued, and the processes of inquiry and synthesis and analysis is valued. But of course, we don't value science very much in our classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the Institute for Inquiry that I visited was just very, it was fascinating to me because it was really all about giving teachers the space in which to understand and to experience the ways in which inquiry-based learning could transform their classrooms.
And I want to invite everybody to come to San Francisco, go to the Exploratorium. It's along the waterfront near the Golden Gate Bridge. And it is a fascinating place of hands-on science where there are different exhibits, and most of them are interactive. And this is before computers, really. It's where you can control, you know, how a device operates or how fast it's going. And you learn so much from actually doing it as opposed to watching it on a screen or even watching somebody else do it.
Yeah, and I, maybe a bit tortured, but I try to draw a parallel between science and science being taught in that way, in the way of, for example, the Exploratorium and civics. Because in civics, you're really trying to get your hands dirty in democracy. And, you know, I profile some places that are doing that in the book, just so you know that the book isn't a complete downer.
No, it's not.
It's not. And, you know, getting your hands dirty and, you know, I look at schools where there's a mandatory change project where students have to work together to come up with a project of something that they want to change in their local community, which involves, of course, understanding the processes and the systems and figuring out, you know, what solutions would be better than the status quo. And, you know, there's the civics to me, not the kind of boring stuff of where you just absorb knowledge, but with civics where you actually practice it, is in the same way as the Exploratorium. You're getting your hands dirty, and that's how it sticks.
One other area that I want to explore before we wrap up here is the presidential debates. And I was so frustrated during the 2008 cycle because we had these massive, gatherings with many candidates, and yet they would only direct questions to those who were leading in the money race and the polls. And so the idea that the debates could help influence policy, even if a Mike Gravel or a Dennis Kucinich was never going to make it to the nomination, has been tossed out. And it's more like American Idol from the very beginning, where they focus in on the front runners, and then occasionally they'll throw gratuitous stuff at those who are not front runners. Oh, like the question about Gravel's finances in a bankruptcy, and about whether Dennis Kucinich talked to UFOs with Shirley MacLaine. And, I like both of those guys. I think they have a lot to say, and even if I don't find them electable in a practical way, I thought Dennis Kucinich had a whole lot to offer on the debate about the economy, about the war, about transparency, and about many constitutional issues. Yet he was, treated as a fringe guy in every respect by the corporate media.
Well, I talk about the debates in the book because I try to make the case that they are one of the primary examples in which people understand the value of questions in democracy, because this is supposedly where our presidential candidates are to be questioned. And, you know, there are, and I think the debates are just getting worse and worse because they're getting more and more closed. And even though we had some innovations this year, you know, around the YouTube debate, they're very heavily scripted, very heavily negotiated conversations. And,
yeah.
You know, I think it was 33 pages or 36 pages of a contract just to do one presidential debate, you know, from where the water goes to where the table goes, and, you know, not allowing for any follow-up questions. And, you know, how do you the audience member can't clarify his or her intention in the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the case I make is that if this is what we think of questions in democracy, then it's no wonder that people feel that they have no place. And so I think we can definitely do better when it comes to the debates. And the question you raise about participation is valid, and who's going to participate, who isn't, is a valid one. I think the question of how the two principal front runners, I don't necessarily have a problem with them being in solo debates when you get into October, but how does that, if it appears that there are only two front runners, but how does, you know, how are they questioned? I think these are all things we have to think about, and I think there are people thinking about, about this Lawrence Lessig Leipzig and others have an open debate coalition. You know, I think this is an area where we could be doing better to create at least the perception that there is a place for citizens' questions.
Yeah, I mean, it boiled down to a really bad game show where, for example, that one debate, we knew that George Stephanopoulos had been fed the question about Bill Ayers from Sean Hannity, because they did it right out in the open on Hannity's radio show. And then, sure enough, that night, Stephanopoulos, well, tell us about Bill Ayers. And,
right.
You know, the trick questions about driver's licenses for non-citizens. And, you know, there was very little. I can't recall one question ever being asked about the constitutional issue of illegal wiretaps, domestic surveillance of Americans. The corporate guys didn't bring it up. Charlie
right.
Gibson was more worried about protecting his multimillion-dollar salary from the capital gains tax.
Right. You know, that was that debate was a particular embarrassment, which stinks because I think sometimes at least those people who are participating can ask good questions. But, you know, it's deeper. And I do think that as politics increasingly becomes performance and as political reporting essentially becomes sports reporting, that that this is what we're going to see.
Tell us about your coda here, your call for slow democracy, Andrea.
Well, I think part of why we don't have much time to inquire in our politics is because we expect answers. And I think that's true in general. You know, that's the reason that the self-help industry is doing quite well, seems to be recession-proof. In fact, recession-positive. And, you know, in the end of the book, I essentially try to make the case that we need to go a little slower. And, you know, if we want politicians, our elected leaders, for example, to come up with you know, policies that will actually benefit us, we can't expect them to respond immediately. And I think we need to think differently about transparency, so that transparency is actually full disclosure, but it isn't immediacy. And I think the more we expect our leaders to have immediate information for us, the less likely it is that they themselves are going to be involved in the questioning process, the more likely it is that they are going to be giving us answers that are unsatisfactory, that aren't deep, that aren't thorough. And so it's harder and harder to do in this culture of instant response. And there's so much that's good about that culture of instant response and so much that's good about that culture of demanding transparency. But I do think that we're confusing transparency and immediacy, and I think we need to find a way to change our expectations so that we have more room for questions. We can't just say we want questions, but then demand answers immediately.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, the 24-hour news cycle and the red and blue streams of information that we talked about earlier make that very, very difficult.
The 24-second news cycle.
Yeah, yeah. Andrea, thank you for a delightful conversation, and I want to recommend the book, The Death of Why, subtitled The Decline of Questioning and the Future of Democracy. It's out in softcover from Barrett Kohler. Andrea Batista Schlesinger, thanks for joining me on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you, Peter.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. I hope you've dropped by peterbcollins.com. Recently upgraded with zippy graphics and a lot of interactivity. I want to hear from you. Give me your feedback. You can go to the contact page or just drop me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. And let me know your thoughts. Longer segments, shorter segments, single topic podcasts. What do you prefer? We're listening. All you got to do is tell us how you feel.
I feel so extraordinary. Something's got a hold on me. I get this feeling I'm in motion. A certain sense of liberty.
My pappy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln.
Well, Pappy, how about a Chevy Volt? They say it gets 230 miles to the gallon with a huge asterisk. Your mileage will be lower.
Have you heard the story of the hot rod race with the Fords and the Lincolns was setting the pace? That story is true. I'm here to say I was driving that Model A. It's got a Lincoln motor and it's really souped up. That Model A body makes it look like a pup's. Got 8 cylinders and uses them all. Got overdrive, just won't stall. With a 4-barrel carb and a dual exhaust, with 411 gears, you can really get lost. Got safety tubes, but I ain't scared. The brakes are good, tires fair.
Thank you, Commander Cody. There is an interesting new report out about who pays the most on a percentage basis for gasoline and which states are making the greatest progress toward weaning us from our addiction. on petroleum products. And joining us to talk about is Darren LaVos. He is the Federal Transportation Policy Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Darren, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Good to be here.
Nice to talk with you. And first up, this hype about the Chevy Volt. First of all, I'm happy to hear that Detroit is making some progress on a hybrid vehicle like this. But it strikes me that this has been a lot of hype for a long, long time, and I've heard some critics say that they never expect the Chevy Volt to actually hit the road. What do you make of this claim now of 230 miles per gallon, which, of course, is really 230 miles on a gallon of gas and a whole lot of electric power?
Well, I don't think the car is vaporware, as some critics claim. I do think it's going to come with a heftier price tag than GM originally anticipated, which is unfortunate. And I think it's going to be a pretty popular vehicle in spite of the high price tag, and that's in part because I don't see gasoline prices coming down anytime soon. In fact, they're probably going to head the other way, or at least stay high, which means that kind of vehicle is going to be popular in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick check, we're up above $3 a gallon here in California again. It had crept down to the upper $2 range, but unleaded regular is about $3. You can find it for just a little under $3 in a few places. But we do see things moving up just 14 cents in the past week. Do you have any forecasts? I know these are difficult predictions to make. But what is the current prospect for stable gasoline prices?
If I took out a crystal ball and tried to figure that out, I'd just end up eating the shards of that crystal ball, I'm sure. It's awfully hard to tell. I do know that prices are likely to go through some of the similar volatile swings that we've seen in recent years, and they're likely to stay at a high plateau and more likely to rise than to drop substantially. And I think evidence of that is that we all feel like there's been an ease in the price of gasoline at the pump this year because of the downturn in the economy. And that's true, but only in a relative sense. I was looking at historic data back in 1998, not that long ago. The price of gasoline in a lot of parts of the country dropped below $1 a gallon, which just seems unimaginable now. So, I think the future, unfortunately, the trend line is in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here in California, we've felt that the market was rigged in many respects. We've always paid a little more because of the emissions requirements here. And also, we have seen that strategically, refineries will be shut down for maintenance right at a time when supplies are tightening, and it can have some impact on prices in the short term. Overall, is the supply relatively stable, and are the price spikes due to crude costs or speculation? What are some of the drivers right now?
Well, I'm sure speculative froth played some role in the dramatic price rises we saw, especially last year, where we broke the $4 a gallon level for the first time. But I think fundamentals play the main role here. Just insatiable demand in this country, as well as in China especially, coupled with harder and harder to access supplies of oil, which means that it's costlier to extract. And that's a recipe for high prices right there, which means, we got to find a way to get off of oil, especially in transportation, if we're going to get some relief from that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Darren, you've published a report at NRDC, and people can find it on the web at nrdc.org, and it rates the vulnerability rankings. This is what you call oil vulnerability rankings by state, and it's based on figures from the prior year, from 2008. Give us the elevator pitch. What's the concept behind this study and this designation of states by their oil vulnerability?
Well, what we've done for the third year in a row is take a look at states and rated them based on two criteria. One is just how much are drivers' budgets being burdened by the money they have to pay for gasoline. And we looked at that as a percentage of a driver's budgets. And what we found is that from 2006 to 2008, across the board, the percentage of our income that we have to devote to buying gasoline increased. That's mostly due to the price trends that we saw. And Mississippi tops the ranking, and drivers there, unfortunately, spend almost one-tenth of their income on gasoline.
Now, is this partly a function that they have lower incomes? Because, you know, Mississippi's close to oil refineries. I would think that they would benefit from that proximity and that the actual price at the pump would be a little lower.
Well, there's three factors that drive states up or down in this ranking. One is how efficient the fleet of vehicles is, how many miles per gallon of gasoline on average that fleet gets.
Okay.
Two is how much driving people have to do to meet their daily needs. And then three, you're absolutely right, is the denominator in this equation, which is income. So incomes do help determine what percentage of budgets has to go to gasoline. That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, it's very hard to compare patterns. This is just an observation on my part that's not based on any real technical study. But in New England, for example, you know, the cities are closer together. Things are more compact. And even if you live in one town and work in the next, you're not likely to be commuting 150 miles a day. In California, in Montana, which ranked number two in your vulnerability rankings, people are driving longer distances. And, of course, the fleets in many of those states, the autos that are actually on the road, include a lot of pickup trucks, SUVs that are gas guzzlers. And so, you know, you can understand how these rankings are developed with those factors in mind.
Well, and I just to make it clear, I think you just mixed apples and oranges by talking about California as number one.
Well, let's separate the fruit salad. Go ahead and correct
me.
Sure.
The first ranking is the vulnerability ranking, so percentage of the incomes that has to go to buy gasoline. The second ranking is based on policy solutions, and what we did is we looked at about a dozen policies that we judged would help to reduce the amount of the gasoline dependence for consumers in states, and then graded states based on that. And on that list, California is at number one, and that's because of the Clean Cars Law, that's because of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, that's because of a lot of the global warming legislation that California's put in place since the turn of the century will also help to make cars more efficient and to push more alternatives to gasoline out there for transportation. So California actually fares pretty well in both of these rankings.
Yeah, in the vulnerability ranking, we're 33 out of the 50 states. 5.16% of income is spent on gasoline, and so that does put us in a better position. And
that's
we're
right.
We're delighted to be number one on the policy side because we're not number one in much right now.
Yeah, and things are hard all over the place, including in California, I know, in terms of state budgets, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's right.
Now, I don't know if this happened in time to go into your factoring of the policy positions, but we dodged not a bullet, but a drill here recently in the incredible deadlocked budget impasse negotiations. The governor wanted to sneak in a provision that would allow for expanded offshore drilling. And to be specific, he wanted to allow a federal platform that's currently legal for oil drilling just off the shore of California near Santa Barbara to be the site of a slant drilling rig, which would essentially come, you know, it would use the same platform, but it would drill at an angle into state of California territory, where they appear to believe that there are some oil reserves. And while it's interesting to see that polls show that voters are more open to offshore drilling, even off the California coast, than they have been since the ban was imposed some 30-plus years ago. And so it's very interesting that the legislature, despite the polling that showed the electorate more open to it than, in fact, they were, killed this proposal. And part of the reason was it only would have kicked out about $100 million in the foreseeable future on an annual basis. But I do see some cracks there in terms of public opinion and our own vulnerability because of the budget mess here in California. We're desperate to come up with new revenue sources. And, of course, it would be easy enough to put a wellhead tax on the land-based drilling that occurs in California. There's quite a bit of oil production here. Most people don't know that. And we attempted to put a tax on that through a ballot measure a couple of years ago, and big oil came in and threatened everybody with higher prices, and they were able to defeat it.
I can't comment on any drilling proposals because I haven't actually seen them. I can say that the issue with the price of crude and how it affects the price that we ultimately pay at the pump is, first of all, it's a global market, and so we're subject to the whims of that global market. Second of all, it does make up the majority of what we end up paying at the pump. That's been especially the case in recent years where the price of crude has just ballooned. So it trumps the price of refining, the price of marketing the gasoline, and the price of, in terms of state and federal taxes as well. So, that has been the driver of prices, especially in recent years. And the unfortunate reality is that it's a global marketplace that we deal with.
Well, let me ask you to expand on that notion just a little bit. This is something I have always been curious about. In the campaign for the ballot measure I just mentioned that would have put a tax on oil production here in California, the proponents offered a statistic which surprised me. 42% of the gasoline consumed in California comes from crude oil that was pumped out of the ground, or in some cases offshore, in California. And I thought that we were much more reliant on imported outside sources. But this provides an interesting snapshot, Darren, because we know that, for example, the Chevron refinery that's just across the bay from me has a mix of crude oil. And some of it they paid, the current spot market price, which is in the $60 range. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Yeah, so we're somewhere around $60 a barrel. But a lot of that was drilled from wells that they have owned for 30, 50, 80 years. And the cost of that barrel of crude is not the same as what it costs on the spot market. So how do they blend together these various costs and come up with the retail price that we pay at the pump? when it is a, it's a cocktail. it's a fruit salad of crude oil from all over the place that they paid different prices
salad.
For.
That's right. And you're going to see prices vary at retail, at the retail level as well. We still produce, not just in California, but across the country, a substantial amount of oil so that imports nationally as well as in California are not at 100%. In fact, far from it. We import more than 60% of our oil nationally, and so you have a similar picture there. Where we actually the number's increasing, unfortunately, because we haven't seen since 1970 we've seen a flatlining of domestic oil production. No matter how much investment we continue to pour into it, we're just there's been pretty much a peaking of domestic oil production. So we depend more and more on imports. And in terms of how that translates into the price at the pump, it's partly due to whatever price is paid, all told, for the mix of crude, domestic and imported, and then however much is spent by the company in question refining the product and marketing it, and then however much the state chooses to tax that product for. And then, of course, there's a 18.5 cents federal gas tax as well. So all of that adds up to what we pay at the pump. Most of it is about the price of crude. So.
And there's no government oversight, is there, of the pricing of petroleum products? It's all up to the companies and what the market will bear?
There is some oversight, but it's pretty minimal, and that's actually been something that, you know, certainly was debated over the past couple of years when we saw the price run-ups, whether or not there should be more oversight and more assurance by the government that there isn't a lot of speculative froth that's driving the prices up in an unwarranted and harmful way. So, you know, and I think we're going to see a lot of those debates get reopened as the economy rebounds and prices inevitably rise again.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this, just to touch on the report again, I mean, what we're hoping is that through state policy and through federal policy that we can actually reduce our reliance on this commodity so we're not our lifestyles and our budgets aren't held hostage as much as they currently are to the price hikes and spikes of gasoline at the pump. I mean, we rely on this one particular fuel for transportation far too much, and we should be able to choose other options when the price rises. There should be more competition in the marketplace between energy sources. Mm-hmm. We think that would be all to the good.
And Darren, one of the things that comes to mind as you're just describing that is that we have a number of anomalies that are impacted by the economic problems that we're having. So, for example, people are actually consuming less gasoline in California, but because the state taxes attached to gasoline are on a per gallon instead of a per dollar, a percentage basis, the revenues to the state for highway maintenance and mass transit subsidies, for example, are actually declining. So do we need to rework some of our tax and regulatory structures with an eye toward reducing the vulnerability that you're talking about and really creating appropriate incentives so that there isn't this kind of disincentive to reduce consumption?
Oh, well, that's a very good question, and actually we have the same problem at the federal level. I think Washington State is probably the only state that stands out as a state that has recently increased its gas tax and has a pretty well-funded transportation program as a consequence. Federal gas tax hasn't been increased since 1993, so its investment power has been eroding year in and year out for the past 15 years or so. I think California is in the same boat, and I think it makes sense to find some way to increase the revenue into the program that funds repairs to our transportation infrastructure, whether it be through a variable tax that moves up and down depending on the price of gasoline. So on a percentage basis, as you said, that might make sense. I tell you, though, it's going to be hard to ask taxpayers to put more money into this program when I think their faith is at a low ebb, that it won't go to the money won't go to highways and bridges to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I really think people are concerned about the pork barrel projects that get funded through state and federal transportation programs. So we can't put the cart before the horse. Those programs need to be reformed before we go to the taxpayers and say, you know, we need more money for our infrastructure. They need some assurance that government's going to spend that money wisely.
Mm-hmm. And, Darren, one of the things I would like to have seen from the stimulus bill that was passed earlier this year was some replacement subsidies for mass transit, because California is not the only state with a huge budget problem. And one of the sad realities is that the cuts include subsidies to public transit. And in turn, they then have to raise fares, which typically reduces ridership. And so this, again, one of these unintended consequences and a kind of policies that were set in the past that really don't, I think, reflect the urgent needs that we have today.
I think that's absolutely right. The federal government has not helped fund transit operations for far too long. It should get back into that game. And also, proportionally, more federal money should go to build more public transportation infrastructure, especially if we're going to see gas prices increase again in the future. Because we saw, you know, last year especially, a lot of people moved from driving to taking transit in our urban areas. That provides a lot of benefits, saving fuel, reducing pollution, reducing congestion on our roads, all of that. And if we can expect more of the same in terms of fuel prices in the future, and I think we can, we need to boost investment in transit, not reduce it right now, not cut it back. So I think you're absolutely right.
Well, and the feds are pumping money into high-speed rail, and that would certainly benefit us here in California. So I don't want to paint a picture that I see everything negative. But by the time the high-speed rail projects get built, our public transit systems may have crumbled.
Yeah, well, that's right. And the other thing is that, you know, not just that cutting-edge kind of infrastructure we need. I mean, we need more buses. We need more rail in our cities. We need more commuter rail. I mean, we need more mundane public transportation investments, so to put it. And something that people aren't paying attention to is the fact that Congress is now looking at passing a new federal transportation bill. And those things determine how tens of billions of our taxpayer dollars are spent every year. And, you know, so it's not just the climate bill, it's not just the health care bill. There's a third very big bill that Congress is considering right now, and it's being overlooked by a lot of people, and we need to hold Congress accountable, make sure they put more money for public transportation and for rail in that bill.
Well, we better run to a town hall meeting and shout it down.
Yeah, well, that's right. I can think of, we can come up with some good signs, showing rail lines and that kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh. Hey, Darren, what kind of a grade would you give Ray LaHood? He is a former Republican congressman from Illinois, one of the non-Democrats in the Obama cabinet. And tell me what your thoughts are after his first 6 or 7 months on the job. Number one, is he up to the task, and does he have a vision that you approve of? And number two, as a Republican, is he able to get things done in a Democratic administration with a Democratic Congress?
Well, I have to say, when he was first appointed earlier this year, like others who work on transportation, I was surprised and wary. Now, though, partly because of his backing of the high-speed rail initiative and the good planning that the Transportation Department has done on that, and partly because of the amazing team he surrounded himself with, and people don't realize this outside of the Beltway, but Secretary LaHood has recruited a top-notch set of policy experts out of Congress and out of the private sector.
Well, and take a moment here, because I was looking at your blog, and you were particularly pleased with the appointment of a guy named Roy Kienitz.
That's right. Roy Kienitz, many years ago, a couple decades ago, worked for Senator Patrick Moynihan, of course, of New York State. And Senator Moynihan was the brains behind the last reformed transportation bill that Congress passed in 1991. And Roy helped to write that bill. And he came to the administration from Governor Rendell's administration in Pennsylvania. He had worked for the Department of Planning in Maryland before that, so he has a lot of seasoning. He's very good. The Secretary of Transportation for Maryland left that post to become Deputy Secretary and work alongside of Roy for Secretary LaHood. There's several other people that have been brought over from the U.S. Senate from some of the best offices there focusing on transportation policy. So who Secretary LaHood has surrounded himself with, I think, speaks volumes about his commitment to changing transportation policy for the better so that it saves fuel and reduces pollution. It's been a pleasant surprise, really, dealing with him and with his staff.
And while he is a Republican, he's a former member of Congress, so he certainly knows how things work on the Hill. As you observe in these first few months, has he had pretty good working relationships with the key committees?
He has, and I look forward to him and his staff engaging even more. The trick with these administrations is that no matter how fast they move, it takes a while to staff up because the senior appointments all have to go through Senate confirmation. So this staff that he has taken several months to assemble. So I think they really need to engage more with Congress, and they're just beginning to. So I think I look forward to a lot more of that in the future. Just as an example, that there's a new Assistant Secretary of Transportation who used to work for, actually, Senator Boxer, and she, her swearing in will be next week.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not even, you know, she doesn't even have a desk at the department yet, and that's just the reality about these big departments here in D.C. is they take a while to staff up.
Yeah. Well, Darren, thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us today to talk to this talk about this report. People can find it at nrdc.org, and we're going to post the link to your blog on the show information at our website at peterbcollins.com, so people can drop in there and keep up with your commentary.
Great. Thanks, Peter.
And our final trick question, if you have a car, what do you drive?
Oh, well, first of all, I live right next to Metro here in D.C., so most of the time I take public transportation. When I don't, I drive a Honda Civic Hybrid.
Okay. Love to check these things out. Thanks for joining us, Darren. Good to talk with you.
All right. Take care.
Whatever you drive, I hope you drive carefully out there. And stay away from Dead Man's Curve, will you? Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.